To RPH provides this edition of the Newcastle Herald for Thursday, the 18th of April, for listening on demand. We remind you that the program is copyright and, in accordance with our agreement with the publisher, is available for a period of 24 hours only from the time of original broadcast completion. You're reminded, as this is a recording, all included time calls should be disregarded.
Your radio reading service, 2RPH, brings you news, comment and letters from the pages of today's Newcastle Herald.
Hello, good morning and thank you for joining us for today's reading of the Newcastle Herald for today, Thursday the 18th of April 2024. I'm John Martin and I'm delighted that with me in the studio today is Connie Mason to read the paper for you. Good morning, Connie.
Good morning, John, and to the listeners.
And over the next 90 minutes, we'll have lots of local news, local sports. At about 10 past 11, there are today's funeral notices, followed by today's editorial in the opinion column, and then we'll end off the programme with the letters to the editor. But before we start reading, let's just have a quick look at the weather forecast. Today's top temperature is expected to be about 25 degrees. Conditions will remain partly cloudy with a high chance of showers and the chance of a thunderstorm during this morning as well as this afternoon. The winds will be light. Overnight, a minimum of 13 degrees is expected and tomorrow's top around 23. Again, it will be partly cloudy with a high chance of showers, mostly in the afternoon and evening. Light winds becoming southerly, 15 to 25 kilometre hour in the middle of the day, and then tending southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres per hour in the late evening. Well, let's have a look then at what today's Newcastle Herald presents, and to read the front page, here's Connie.
We've got two articles on today's front page, and the first is by Madeline Link, and the title of that article is Taking a Stand for Kids in Crisis. Nin Bennett will join fellow child protection caseworkers to protest outside Edgeworth's Community Services Centre today after it was announced the site would close despite the growing number of children in need of help. Ms Bennett said the closure of the centre would be a blow for the community and another setback for the broken child protection system in New South Wales. Now, that article has a full report on page 6 and we'll read that for you later in the programme. Now to the second headline on the front page, and that's an article by Sage Swinton. It's a letters saga that you may be familiar with, and the title of that article is City Releases Report at Last. City of Newcastle has released the investigation report into allegations about the Council Chief Executive Jeremy Barth's connections with Newcastle Herald serial letter writer Scott Nalan. The release of the report, described as proactive by the Council, comes after 4 months of community pressure following the announcement of the Pinnacle Integrity Investigation result in December, which said there was no evidence the CEO directly contributed to the letters. The Council resolved in December to proactively consider and seek advice on whether the full report could be released in accordance with the Government Information Public Access Act and has since consulted with third parties. Mr. Barth welcomed the release of the report yesterday, saying it confirmed he did not write letters to the Newcastle Herald, published under the name of my friend Scott Nalan. But complainant Bob Cook said the report confirmed his belief that it was not a true investigation. The report outlines the steps taken to conclude there was insufficient evidence that Mr. Barth behaved in a manner that constituted a breach of the Council's Code of Conduct. And that article continues on page 7. The investigation probed two allegations: whether Mr. Barth passed on confidential information to Mr. Nalin, which Mr. Nalin included in letters to the Herald, or that Mr. Barth wrote one of the letters, which related to the Newcastle Maritime Museum. The Herald received 18 letters to the editor from Mr. Nalin, five of which were published. The Herald was not contacted by the investigator. The report states Herald articles were reviewed, but did not form the basis of allegations probed. Interviews were conducted with two main complainants, Maritime Museum President Bob Cook and Lord Mayor Nuitali Nulms. Mr. Nalin provided written responses, while Mr. Barth was not formally interviewed, but was spoken to twice and provided information. The interviews were conducted between August the 24th and October the 25th. Interviews were voluntary, conducted on notice, and each person was given an opportunity to speak freely. The report said the interviews remained the property of Pinnacle. Emails between Mr. Barth and Mr. Cook were reviewed after Mr. Cook said Mr. Nalin's letters contained information only known by himself and Mr. Barth. The investigation did not find that an unpublished letter written by Mr. Nalin to the Herald in July 2023 contained confidential information only known to Mr. Cook and Mr. Barth. A letter from 2019 was excluded due to Clause 4.4 of the Council's Administration of the Code of Conduct, which states a complainant must be made within 3 months of the alleged conduct occurring, or within 3 months of the complainant becoming aware of the alleged conduct. Clause 4.5 states a complainant made after 3 months, a complaint made after 3 months, can be accepted if the allegations are deemed serious. The report includes redactions, including the identity of an MP mentioned by the Lord Mayor as having animosity towards the council. Mr. Barth said he welcomed the release of the full report. I have at all times made myself available to the conduct reviewer, undertaking both verbal and written interviews, he said. I understand why securing the release of the report has taken time, given the New South Wales Model Code of Conduct policy makes a presumption against the release of the investigation report when no breach of conduct has occurred. The report confirms what I have always said. I did not write letters to the Newcastle Herald, published under the name of my friend Scott Nalin. Mr. Cook said the release of the report confirms his belief that it was not a true investigation. It certainly has two people who are the best of friends telling the same story, he said. The report hasn't verified whether things either of them said were true. The report uses words that concern me: reasonable, plausible, conceivable. Those are not the words of an investigator that's proving anything. Pinnacle Integrity said the reviewer's role is to establish the truth, having regard to available evidence. In a scrupulously objective, independent and fair process, it said, conduct reviewers do not hold coercive legislative powers, interrogate witnesses, seize records, nor enforce participation in the process. The review is neither prosecutorial nor it is an acquisition seeking to apportion guilt to validate a predetermined or preferred outcome. In this instance, there is a published prevailing view that our role ought to have been to prosecute a person subject of complaint to ratify a preferred finding. That is not and will never be our role. Our role is to assess available evidence rather than rely on inference, assumptions, or innuendo. Some parties will be disappointed with the outcome of the complaint inquiries. That is inevitable, but does not dictate or influence investigative outcomes. And that article, which appeared originally on page one, was titled City Releases Report at Last, and it was by Sage Swinton.
And we turn back now to page 2, and the first story there is defence to get an extra $50 billion in complete rebuild. The reporter is Miriam Webber. Richard Marles has announced a complete rebuild of defence's planned procurement, including the reprioritisation of $72.8 billion over the decade. The Defence Minister unveiled the update investment programme as he announced Australia's first national defence strategy. Federal funding for defence is now expected to reach more than $50 billion over the next decade, with Mr. Marles announcing an additional $1 billion over the next 4 years. The Integrated Investment Plan, which sets out a 10-year procurement pathway for defence, has been allocated $330 billion in total. The AUKUS deal will be a centrepiece of the plan, with $53 to $63 billion to go towards acquiring a nuclear-powered submarine capability over the next 10 years. A $50.3 billion investment in defence over the next decade will focus on updating and improving capabilities in the forces and strengthening and integrating space and cyber capability. The update required the reprioritisation of the $22.5 billion over the next 4 years and $72.8 billion over the decade. Reallocating spending cannot occur without difficult decisions, Mr. Miles said. Just as important as what we are doing are the decisions we have taken about what we are not. This will include the diversion of $1.4 billion for planned enhancements to defence facilities in Canberra, to operational bases in Darwin, Townsville and Learmonth. Plans to acquire two large support vessels for the Navy will also be scrapped, generating savings of $120 million over the next 4 years and $4.1 billion over the decade. The strategy is set against the backdrop of uncertainty and tensions of entrenched and increasing strategic competition between the United States and China, Mr. Miles said, as well as large-scale war on the European continent and conflict in the Middle East. Announcing the strategy on Wednesday, Mr. Miles said it focused on preparing defence to deter a potential adversary from projecting force against Australia, including the capability to hold the military assets of an adversary at risk at greater distance from our shores. It also aims to ensure that Australia can work with partners to help deter broader conflict in our region that would be disastrous for us all. In this way, the government seeks to invest in a sustainable strategic balance in the Indo-Pacific, Mr. Miles said. A balance where no state is militarily predominant and in which no state judges that the benefit of conflict might outweigh the risks. Australia's Integrated Investment Program reveals projects planned by defence and required investments into the future. The strategy is the first of its kind, drawn up in response to a recommendation in the Defence Strategic Review. It will be updated biannually and is intended to lay out a detailed overview of defence policy, planning, capabilities and resourcing. The Defence Strategic Review, released in April 2023, found that Australia's Defence Force was not fully fit for purpose and made dozens of recommendations which targeted shifting focus to longer-range strike missiles and increasing presence in the in northern bases. Other key areas for action included the AUKUS submarine deal, improving workforce retention, deepening diplomatic and defence partnerships, and growing capacity to turn new technology into defence force capability. In response to the review, the government reprioritised an initial $7.8 billion in programs to 2027, causing changes to 21 projects, delays to 6, and cancellations of a further 6. And that was Defence to get extra $50 billion in complete rebuild, and it was written by Miriam Webber. And also on page 2, a brief item in the Community Notice Board. Services Australia's Mobile Service Centre, Golden Wattle, will visit the Mid-North Coast region. They will offer easy access to Centrelink, Medicare, a National Disability Insurance Scheme, and Department of Veterans Affairs Services. Golden Wattle will come to Bulahdelah on April the 26th from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. And full details of that are available on the Services Australia website. And that was a Community Notice Board item.
And also on page 2, an article by Simon McCarthy, Strategy Eyes Region as Industry Hub. The Hunter region has been positioned as a defence industry hub in the Indo-Pacific in the Albanese government's first national defence strategy. 10 manufacturing, engineering and technology outfits with facilities in the region have been singled out for their roles building, upgrading and maintaining defence equipment with a particular focus on the Air Force's wing of 5th generation fighter jets. Yesterday's announcement projected a more than $50 billion splurge on national defence readiness spending over the next 10 years, with more than $5 billion to be spent in the next 4 years. BAE Systems, among other Hunter notables, including Boeing, Lockheed Martin, which makes the jets, and Raytheon, were noted for their roles servicing several aircraft in the national arsenal, including the F-35A, Hawk 127, E-7 Wedgetail, and the F-A-18 Hornets, which were retired in 2021. In December, BAE Systems, which maintains and service the F-35A, was in line for a rapid $110 million government-funded hangar upgrade near Newcastle Airport to accommodate the larger jets. Australia has accepted 63 of the world's most advanced fighter jets of a total allotment of 72 based in Williamtown and Tyndall and maintained in the Hunter. The Australian Defence magazine reported in January that BAE Systems upgrade could potentially pursue Newcastle Airport as a service and maintenance centre of the globe of more than 3,000 aircraft. Engineering and manufacturing out Varley and Tails at Carrington and Sibmet at Tomago are, meanwhile, in line to produce marine and land vehicles and equipment. And video game publisher Bohemia Interactive and simulation tech developer Applied Virtual Simulation have been tapped for tactical training, mission rehearsal software and other simulation support. The Hunter region has a long and proud history in defence today. Today's announcement ensures this will continue, Mr. Conroy said yesterday. Today's announcements lock in thousands of well-paid, highly skilled defence jobs across the region and will create many more over the years to come. And the article, Strategy Eyes Region as Industry Hub, was by Simon McCarthy.
And we go on to page 3, an article there written by Madeline Link, Call to Clean Up Derelict Eyesore. Neighbours are fed up with a lack of action on two derelict and abandoned homes that they say are not only an eyesore but could pose an asbestos risk to the community. The two unsecured homes on the corner of Maud and Ernest Streets at Belmont sit on a site previously approved for a $6.9 million multi-storey apartment complex with a commercial space on the ground floor. But instead, they've become a home to squatters and a dangerous playground for children after one of the houses was significantly damaged in a fire in September. Magnus Holland, who lives nearby, said he thought the fire would have been the final straw for their demolition. We've mentioned it to council and filed a report with our safety concerns. They've investigated. The owners are apparently not communicating with them or anyone else, he said. They're wide open. There's no doors on them, no fencing, and basically kids being curious are going in and out and are being exposed to God knows what. There's been squatters in there. It's overrun with trash, drug paraphernalia, syringes. It's not good. Council records show the properties are owned by Ernest Street Development Pty Limited. The apartment complex was approved in 2019, but there has been no progress on construction since. A Lake Macquarie Council spokesman confirmed it had received 3 complaints in the last 12 months about this property and said there is potentially asbestos in the building's eaves. We've previously contacted the property owner in relation to the neighbours' concerns and were told that the site would shortly be redeveloped, he said. However, with no development undertaking taking place, council has today, that was on Wednesday, issued a notice of intention to serve an order. If the property owner doesn't take action within 28 days, we will issue an order to demolish the building. The Newcastle Herald contacted the developer about the future of the properties, but did not receive a response. Jim Clarence has lived across the road for the last 8 years and said, after the DA was approved, they were rented out sporadically until 2020. After that, he said the condition of the properties went significantly downhill. I think they got to the stage where they were uninhabitable. We had squatters move in there and it got worse and worse, he said. Someone took out the window next to the door, punched a hole through the door. We suspect there was drug dealing going on in there as well. The place slowly but surely has become overgrown. Anything worth taking has been stripped, and there's grass a metre and a half high with rats coming out across the road. Greg Forbes has lived on Maud Street for more than 2 decades and said the buildings need cleaned up. Even the footpath is overgrown, the grass is like a metre high, the garbage bin are chock-a-block and overflowing. It's just a disgrace, really. The council's no intention will include a requirement to make the site secure. And that was written by Madeline Link. Call to clean up derelict eyesore.
And staying now on page 3, an article by Anna Mayer. High-flying jets set to land record-breaking crowd for final. The Newcastle Jets are set to make history this weekend with a crowd of thousands behind them. Tickets for the A-League Women's Semi-Final Showdown with Melbourne City FC at Maitland-on-Say have set the team on a record-breaking path. Around 4,500 tickets to the first of a 2-legged semi-final had been sold by 3 p.m. on April the 17th. They only went on sale to members at 10 a.m. on Monday and to the general public on Tuesday morning. This will be the biggest women's football game ever in the region, Mr. Matiski said. The Jets have averaged a home crowd of 2,418 this season across 11 games, with a club record turnout for the women of 3,842 against Sydney FC on December the 10th. The biggest home crowd the side has ever had for was more than 4,000 at McDonald Jones Stadium in recent years, Mr. Matiski said, a record set to be broken this weekend at Maitland. He said, having a strong legion of supporters behind the Jets at Sunday's match against the richer Melbourne City FC would be crucial. We back ourselves as the underdog, and we know our team is on a roll at the moment, he said. This is a critical game. This is not just top football. This is semi-finals. We do need support. We want this game sold out. That will be our big advantage. The club was waiting for confirmation from Maitland County Council on the capacity of the sports ground on Tuesday afternoon, but it was likely to be less than 8,000. Mr. Matiski said the Jets women love smaller grounds like Maitland and number 2 sports ground in Newcastle. The atmosphere at those grounds is incredible, he said. The spirit in the game is played in the way the crowd supports the team. It's something different to ordinary sporting contests. It's a great vibe. And that article, High Flying Jets Set to Land Record-Breaking Crowd for Final, was by Anna Falkenmayer.
And the last story on page 3 is written by Miklos Bolza, and the headline is NRL Star's Brother to Consider Legal Action. The brother of Brisbane Bronco prop Payne Haas is considering taking civil action against authorities after police withdrew all drug charges against him. Zeta Haas had been accused, along with another man, after being stopped in a ute at Beresfield in August, shortly after collecting a package. Police said that they detected the package border and had removed 1.8 kilograms of methamphetamine shipment before sending it on. Australian Border Force officers intercepted 2 parcels from the United States containing a combined 4 kilograms of methamphetamine, street value of $3.5 million. Haas was charged with count of supplying a commercial quantity of a prohibited drug and one of trafficking a commercial quantity of a controlled drug. The Newcastle Herald wrote that charges against Haas were dismissed at Newcastle local court last week. At a bail hearing in September, a New South Wales Supreme Court judge described the case against Haas as extremely weak. The extent of the evidence against him is that he was in the car with someone who went to this place and picked up this package, Justice Davies said at the time. He said there was in the documents before the court to indicate that Mr. Haas had committed the trafficking charge. His solicitor, Abdul Reslin, confirmed yesterday that Mr. Haas was considering taking civil action over the dropped charges. And that story by Miklos Bolza, NRL star's brother to consider legal action.
And now to page 5 for an article by Jamison Murphy. New chair to steer merged $20 billion Hunter financial giant. The $20 billion entity born out of the merger of Newcastle Permanent and the Greater Bank has revealed its new incoming chair. Samantha Martin-Williams has been appointed as the new NMG Group Board Head, making her the first woman to hold the position. Miss Martin-Williams, a Hunter Valley local and a respected business leader, brings a wealth of board experience to the role. In 2012, she became the first female director of Newcastle Permanent and transitioned to the NGM Group Board following a 2023 merger. The new bank, which is retaining both the Permanent and Greater brands, is just over a year old, but was already delivering on its promises to members. The merger promises were really about value to customers, Ms. Martin-Williams said. In a year, we've been able to reduce fees, and it mightn't seem much, but if you're a customer, and that is a friction point, the reduction in fees for an everyday account is really a significant thing. We've seen our customer numbers increase. We've seen our customer deposits increase. We've seen our home loan portfolio increase as well across both brands. Ms. Martin-Williams will take the helm from Wayne Russell in November, who will retire at the group's annual general meeting. Deputy Chair Jeff Ether will also retire at the AGM, and Rod Jackson has been appointed to replace him. In handing over to Sam and Rod, I could not be more confident in the organisation's future, Mr. Russell said. Sam has a proven track record of advancing the agenda of regional business in Australia, which, coupled with Rod's industry experience, will build on NGM Group's already strong position in the industry. Ms. Martin-Williams said the financial giant had a desire to diversify into new regions through both a physical presence and a digital one. And that article by Jamison Murphy was headlined "New Chair to Steer Merged $20 Billion Hunter Financial Giant."
And the time is coming up to 10:30.
Hello, this is Gary Robertson from Down Under. Now there's another way you can hear 2RPH. We're streaming live from our website on www.2rph.org.au.
Has anyone in your family had liver problems? Hepatitis B can affect the whole family and cause serious liver disease. Around 230,000 people in Australia are living with the hepatitis B virus. There is no cure yet, and if left unchecked, hepatitis B can cause liver cancer. A simple blood test can show whether you have hepatitis B. There is a hepatitis B vaccine and good treatment available to help protect you and your family from liver disease. Talk to your doctor or call 1-800-437-222 or log on to hepatitisaustralia.com.
This is your radio reading service to RPH.
And in our reading of today's Newcastle Herald, we're still on page 5, and the second story there is by Jameson Murphy. Newcastle checks more boxes, according to Bank Boss. The head of one of Australia's big four banks has given Newcastle a ringing endorsement, declaring it checks more boxes than most parts of the country, including the capital cities. ANZ Chief Executive Shane Elliott was also full of praise for the Hunter Valley, which he described as part of the country that stacks up incredibly well on his regional tour of the nation. "This is a really vibrant place with lots of opportunity. The economy feels like it's got real resilience to it, and the population growth is really strong," Mr. Elliott said in an address to the region's business leaders. "Good lifestyle, jobs, opportunity, infrastructure. You've got a lot of things here that are going to attract talent. Not all of regional Australia has those sorts of opportunities." Newcastle checks more boxes than most parts of the country, including, frankly, the capital cities. Housing in the region, although still expensive, was more affordable than Sydney and attracting housing refugees. They're people who can't afford to buy, or rent for that matter, in Greater Sydney, and the Hunter looks like a pretty good alternative to them, Mr. Elliott said. "What is really interesting to me is that population growth is now largely millennial. It's young people with skills who are coming here to create a future." Although it was Mr. Elliott's first time in Newcastle, he said, "The city is actually in my blood, as his great-grandfather was born in Newcastle in 1869. However, he assured the crowd his glowing appraisal of the city had nothing to do with his genetic Novocastrian bias. That optimism and investment opportunity isn't uniformly the same around the country, so I don't want people to think, oh, that's what you say everywhere," Mr. Elliott said. "The region may have all the right ingredients for a strong economic future, but everything still need to get everything lined up to unlock its potential, and that's the hard work. To unlock that potential, our role is to provide capital," he said. "There's lots of things that we need that need to be provided: infrastructure, planning, approvals, and obviously labour. A big part of why we're here is to ask, how do we divert capital to assist all that transition that's going on?" ANZ released a report into hydrogen on Wednesday, which gives an insight into an emerging industry Mr. Elliott believed could be potent. "Hydrogen is a big chunk of the region's future economically," he said. "As is offshore wind we've heard about. All the renewable pieces, a lot of that stuff requires significant investment, and that's what we're here to do." And that story was written by Jameson Murphy. Newcastle checks more boxes, bank boss said.
Now to page six for the full report on the front page article taking and for kids in crisis. It's by Madeleine Link, and this article is headed Caseworkers to Protest Officer. Child protection caseworkers paralysed by mounting paper, chronic understaffing and burnout, will take a stand against a system they say is broken and puts vulnerable children at risk. Staff protest outside Edgeworth Community Service Centre, or CSC, today after management announced the site was facing closure despite the growing number of children who needed help. Public Service Association, PSA, Delegate Nin Bennett formerly worked as an early childhood educator and became a caseworker 2 years ago in the hope she could make a difference. The reality of life on the casework side is very different to what I thought it would be, she said. Ms. Bennett said she spent 80% of her time doing administrative work, spending just 1 hour every five or 6 weeks with each individual child in and out of home care. When you look at it realistically, that is dismal, she said. It shatters me to know I'm not making the difference that I can actually have the potential to make, and that is all due to time constraints and caseload. If the Edgeworth CSC is closed, Ms. Bennett said the local community will suffer. She said, rather than decommissioning the Edgeworth CSC could occur later this year, staff had requested another local office to be opened in its place. It's understood DCJ has started consulting with the staff about the building, with the lease expiring in September. As part of the protest, child protection caseworkers have demanded Minister for Families and Communities, Kate Washington, and the state government immediately recruit another 500 caseworkers, give them an immediate and substantial pay rise, and deprivatise foster care. Ms. Washington said last year, when the state government scrapped the punitive wages cap set by the former coalition government, child protection workers gained their largest pay increase in more than a decade. We respect union members exercising their rights, and we are continuing to have productive conversations with the PSA. She said the state government was embarking on significant structural reform to fix the broken child protection system. A critical element of our reform will involve the attraction and retention of caseworkers. We must ensure they feel supported while they do one of the most important jobs in the world, keeping children safe. Last week, child protection caseworkers declared the New South Wales child protection system was in crisis and announced the start of an industrial campaign designed to force the New South Wales government to act to save thousands of at-risk kids from further harm. Ms. Bennett said the incomes of child protection caseworkers needed to reflect their role as frontline workers, maintaining safety and supporting vulnerable children. Children and younger people should be at the forefront of everything we do in child protection, she said. The system has been recognised by Ms. Washington as broken, and while ever our system remains broken, children are not at the forefront, and that needs to change. According to Department of Communities and Justice DCJ data, there were 256 vacant full-time positions across the state from October to December 2023. The number of children identified as at risk of serious harm in that same period in the Central Coast and Hunter was 18,321, and of those, just 17%, or 3,191 children, were seen. The PSA says the actual daily vacancy rate in the Hunter and Central Coast is close to 20% due to long-term sick leave and workers' compensation. PSA Assistant General Secretary Troy Wright said Premier Chris Minns needed to intervene. The most vulnerable children in New South Wales are at risk of serious harm, or even worse, because child protection workers are chronically understaffed, exhausted, and management just aren't listening to their concerns, he said. But the response to this crisis by the DCJ management is close offices rather than increase resources. These child protection caseworkers are passionate about their work, and they want Novocastrians to know no urgent child protection responses will be impacted and that skeleton staffing will be maintained at all times during this protest. The Herald contacted DCJ for comment, and that article by Madeline Link had the title Caseworkers to Protest Office Closure.
And we go on to page 7, where there's an unattributed story. The headline is 0.356 driver arrested after court no-show. A woman who failed to appear in court last week after being pulled over with a near-fatal blood alcohol reading of more than 7 times the limit has faced court after a magistrate issued a warrant for her arrest. The Herald reported on Monday that Kelly Bowen, 46, had been a no-show again in Belmont Local Court on April the 10th and was convicted in her absence of high-range drink driving and 3 counts of assaulting a frontline emergency worker. The charges each carry a jail term, and Magistrate Stephen Ollie Slager issued a warrant for Bowen's arrest. The Herald reported on the warrant on Monday, and later that day, Bowen was arrested and appeared in Belmont Local Court in handcuffs on Tuesday. She was later granted bail on a number of conditions, including not drinking alcohol or driving, and she was ordered to appear in court on May 1 to be sentenced. Bowen was pulled over on the Pacific Highway at Gateshead at about 11:15 a.m. on March 19. After a positive roadside breath test, Bowen was arrested and taken to Belmont Police Station, where she recorded a blood alcohol reading of 0.356. Bowen's licence was suspended on the spot, and she was issued a court attendance notice to appear in court on March the 27th. But when Bowen did not appear in court on that day, the magistrate made a note that the registry should notify her of her next court date, April the 10th. When she failed to appear again, Magistrate Ollie Slager heard the matter in her absence, convicted her of all 4 offences, and issued a warrant for her arrest. And that unattributed article was 0.356 driver arrested after court no-show.
And now to page 8 for Sage Swinton's article, Merriweather Carriageway, State Government Should Write a Cheque to Fix Its Error, Bath. Newcastle Council may approach the state government about compensation for an error that allowed a right-of-way to slip off a land title in Merriweather, where public access has been blocked. During a council meeting on Tuesday, City of Newcastle CEO Jeremy Bath said there was nothing stopping the state government from writing a cheque after Merriweather resident Jeff Graham raised the issue of the development at 35 to 37 Llewellyn Street, which had blocked off a right of carriageway formerly used by the public. Certainly we can reach out to the New South Wales Government again and specifically put to them if they would be willing to consider a financial arrangement, and it would in all likelihood need to be with the strata of the building to fund a solution that hopefully could be done without actually requiring significant structural change to the property, Mr. Bath said. We can have those conversations with the New South Government about whether they have any interest in financially compensating everyone for the clear error that occurred under their watch, unfortunately, many years ago. The developer of the site had applied to remove the condition that protected the right-of-way on the land, arguing there were no registered easements on the title. The application was supported by a certificate of title, search date 23rd of the 11th, 2021, which showed the easement was unregistered. The Office of the Registrar General said the site was converted to a new system partly in 1995 and the remainder in 2000, and the easement was not moved over to the new system. The easement was later placed back on the title after the council made an inquiry about the development, which blocked public access to the carriageway. The council has previously said re-establishing public access through the site would require partial demolition of the building, and said its preferred option for public access was through Merriweather Fire Station land next door at 39 Llewellyn Street. The state government has not agreed to this proposal. Independent councillor John Church said on Tuesday night that he did not want to give false hope to residents who wanted access reinstated. There's clear indication from the state government, Councillor Church said. They're not going to give up the land next door. I think that some suggestion that the state government, that is pulling money out of education, is somehow going to find some funds for an isolated small project in Merriweather suburb to fix this problem again. I think it's outrageous that you should give them false hope. We are the consent of authority of the DAs. It's a non-compliant DA. Clearly something happened during the process. We didn't police it, and I think that we shouldn't renege our responsibilities as a council to be part of the solution. The developer claims the DA has been complied with, as unimpeded access is available to the council with a key. Lord Mayor Nuatali Nolms also raised in the meeting that Merriweather Historical Society was looking to take legal action, which she said might be one of the only pathways left, as the council called for an investigation into the private certifier who signed off on the development, but he was later disqualified from the industry. I'm not privy to who knew what, but what I do know is we made a decision at council to keep that access, and it has been built over, and that's not fair, she said. I actually feel for the current residents that are brought into the building that are now going to have to potentially deal with this. But if there is a way to rectify it that suits all parties, then I'm very supportive of what Merriweather Historical Society have proposed to do. And that was an article by Sage Swinton, and it was titled Merriweather Carriageway. State Government Should Write a Check to Fix Its Error. Bath.
And it's 13 minutes to 11.
2RPH podcasts.
Love podcasts? A curated selection of 2RPH programs are available via our podcast partners, including Spotify and Apple. From the latest in assistive technology on AbleQuest to the fascinating world of antiques and art on Antiques Radio Show, simply head to your favourite podcast app and search for 2RPH.
And we go to page 11 of today's Newcastle Herald. The story there is lithium battery starts fire at Shark Ray Centre. The reporters are Nick Bilby and Jessica Brown. A battery fire that ignited at a popular Port Stephens Wildlife Centre yesterday spread to a stash of waste, causing smoke to fill the premises. Emergency crews were called to Irukandji Shark and Ray Encounters on Jessie Road at Anna Bay just before 6:30 a.m. Where they found smoke billowing from a single-storey structure. According to a spokeswoman for New South Wales Fire and Rescue, the blaze started when a lithium iron battery ignited. Staff were on site at the time and were quick to douse the flames with water and evacuate the building. The fire had already spread and a bunch of burning wetsuits was producing a lot of smoke. Rural Fire Service and the Fire and Rescue New South Wales crews remained at the scene, cleaning up and ventilating the building. Atmospheric monitoring later showed that the air was clear of smoke and the centre opened yesterday. The business released a statement confirming that no animals were injured in the fire. During the very early hours of this morning, Irukandji had a small fire outside of our shed. It was quickly contained and we received only minor cosmetic damage. The fire was nowhere near our animals, who were none the wiser, the statement said. We are still open and operating as normal. We thank the community for their support and hope to see everyone soon. And that was Lithium Restarts Fire at Shark Ray Centre, and it was written by Nick Bielby and Brown.
And now to the back page, page 52, for today's sport, an article by Robert Dillon, Knights Tempt Young Raiders to Jump. The Newcastle Knights are close to announcing the signing of James Schiller after agreed terms with the young Canberra Raiders flyer. It is understood, Schiller informed Raiders coach Ricky Stewart on Wednesday, that he has accepted Newcastle's offer to join them next year on a deal for three seasons. The 22-year-old, who debuted in the NRL in 2022, has played in 14 top-grade games, scoring 9 tries. This season he has crossed the stripe 5 times for Canberra in 3 appearances to sit equal second on the NRL's leading try-scorers list. He also scored twice for the Raiders in their heartbreaking 30-28 loss to the Knights in last season's elimination final at McDonald Jones Stadium. As well as outbidding Canberra financially, it is understood that Knights management have indicated to Schiller that there could potentially be an opportunity to play in the centres, having spent the majority of his NRL career on the right wing. Newcastle have deliberately left a vacancy on this year's roster in the hope that they might be able to sign an outside back mid-season, but it is considered highly unlikely the Raiders will consider granting an early release for Schiller, whose form has been so impressive that former New South Wales Origin winger Nick Kotrick has been playing in reserve grade. Three of Newcastle's outside backs, veteran Dan Gagai, experienced Inari Tuala, and injury-played rookie Christian Mapapapalangi, are all off contract at the end of the season. Gagai, 33, told the Newcastle Herald recently that he felt capable of playing for another 2 or 3 years, and he has presented a strong case for retention with some outstanding displays this season. He was recently named in Billy Slater's extended Queensland squad for this year's State of Origin series. The recruitment of Schiller reverses the recent flow of players between Newcastle and the national capital. Canberra's squad features a host of former Knights, including Hudson Young, Joseph Tapin, Danny Levi, Zach Hosking, Zach Wolford, Simi Sasagi and Pasami Sayulo. Schiller is a cousin of Newcastle forward Jack Hetherington, whose father Brett is a Raiders Hall of Famer after helping them win the 1994 Grand Final. Schiller's contract is not expected to be rubber-stamped by the NRL for another few weeks, which left Knights football manager Peter Parr unable to comment. And that article by Robert Dillon appeared on 52, the back page of today's paper.
And also on today's back page is a soccer story, also written by Robert Dillon. O'Neill puts family first in leaving Newcastle. Club captain Brandon O'Neill feels guilty about leaving Newcastle Jets at the end of this season, but says family must come first. O'Neill has been granted a release by the Jets and will return to his hometown of Perth for personal reasons. The 30-year-old is expected to sign with Perth Glory, his original A-League club, but no deal has been confirmed at this point. After 2 seasons and 38 games for Newcastle, O'Neill said it would be hard to part company with his teammates, given the uncertainty about the club's survival beyond the end of this season. He expressed gratitude for how the Jets executive chairman Shane Matisk and coach Rob Stanton have handled his situation. "I'm a proud husband and a proud father first, and I've got a responsibility to look after my wife and daughter," O'Neill said. "It's time I put them first. the sacrifices they make so I can live out my dream and kick a ball around on the weekend, it's about time I started to repay that. O'Neill was confident the Jets would have a prosperous future beyond this season, despite the lack of confirmation regarding a new owner. I feel a bit guilty about it, to be honest. I've got no doubt the Newcastle Jets will be there next year, one way or another, but the one thing everyone wants is some clarity. That's why I feel so guilty, because I've been able to get some clarity for my family's sake. And that story was written by Robert Dillon. O'Neill puts family first in leaving Newcastle.
And now to page 50, and Renee Valentine writes under the headline, Jets set to shoot down heavyweights. The Newcastle Jets are on the precipice of history in an A-League women, facing premiers and formidable force Melbourne City in a two-legged A-League women's semi-final starting in Maitland on Sunday. They have never beaten the competition heavyweights in 15 previous exchanges and squeaked into finals by goal difference. But after recording a club record fourth consecutive win in a marathon elimination final effort against Western United on Saturday night, the Jets look primed to break new ground this weekend. Melina Ayres lives for finals, and her record speaks for itself. No player, including global superstar Sam Kerr, has scored more goals in A-League finals than Ayres. The 25-year-old notched her ninth finals goal with an extra-time winner in Newcastle 4-2 elimination final victory. The Melburnian has a steely determination and brought a winning mentality to the Jets as a key signing this campaign. But injuries and illness has meant we're only just seeing the best of her now. And it looks good. Ayres has played off the bench in the past four matches, all of which Newcastle have won. She has scored five goals in those four appearances to take her season tally quickly to six. In all, the Jets have banged away 18 goals in the past four games and have the best attacking record of the four teams left in the hunt for the championship, with 47 goals in 23 outings. Philippines international Serena Bolden, the find of the season, is leading the way with 14 goals in 18 outings, and pretty much every player in the squad, barring the goalkeepers, has found the back of the net. A concern is that they have legged more goals than any other in the finals race, but in the form they're in, the Jets look like they can outscore anyone. Ask Jets players what pre-season was like, and the unanimous response is brutal. But they are reaping the rewards now. Newcastle play a high-tempo pressing game and can do it for the game's entirety. While the Western United players were calling for the pickle juice as their epic showdown extended into an additional 30 minutes of extra time, the Jets players just kept going. They also have momentum. While City won't have played for 3 weeks, the Jets are full of confidence as well as full of running, and they lose nothing with their bench. A triple substitution of Ayres, Lara Gooch and Sophie Hoban proved devastating to United. A revamped squad has overcome many hurdles this season, including a 20-minute blackout in the elimination final. The loss of A-League Men's Championship-winning coach Gary Van Egmond mid-season to a role in China could have been disastrous, but turned out to be barely noticeable. Off-field uncertainty has surrounded the club, with the new owner still not locked in, but players and coaches have repeatedly chosen to control what they can control. The loss of goalkeeper Izzy Nino to a two-match suspension as they fought for season survival was also navigated successfully, giving coach Ryan Campbell one of the many healthy selections headaches as they eye City. While overcoming adversity, the Jets have broken new ground. An 8-0 rout over Adelaide to seal a finals place was the club's biggest women's win. They are on a record 4-game winning streak and have posted their first ever finals win. When the Jets made finals twice prior, the teams were brimming with big-name players. In 2007-08, Matilda's royalty Cheryl Salisbury, Joey Peters and Kate Gill, plus a baby-faced Emily Van Egmond, led the way. In 2017-18, the side included Van Egmond, now Matilda's Courtney Vine and Claire Wheeler, plus American quartet Katie Stengel, Aaron Gilliland, Tori Huster and Brick Eckerstrom. This season, plenty of unknown talent has been unearthed, including 16-year-old midfielder Emma Dundas, who has established herself as a starting player, as well as the likes of defender Josie Wilson and attacking workhorse Hoban, who were plucked from MPLW obscurity. The Jets have averaged a home crowd of 2,418 this season across 11 games, with the number 2 sports ground record turnout for women's game of 3,842 against Sydney FC on December the 10th. That figure had been eclipsed by Wednesday, with about 4,500 tickets already sold for Sunday's semi-final. And that article by Renee Valentine was titled, Jets Set to Shoot Down Heavyweights.
And with the time coming up to 1 minute past 11, there's a second A-League story on page 50, also written by Renee Valentine, Ownership Uncertainty Proving Motivation in Finals Series. Coach Ryan Campbell believes the club's uncertain future is driving the Newcastle Jets to reach their goal of an A-League Women's Championship. The club has been given until the end of the A-League season to find a new owner or risk folding. But the off-field turmoil has not proven a distraction to on-field performance for their in-form women's side. The Jets finished sixth to break a six-year finals drought, then overpowered third-place Western United in an elimination playoff in Tarnate on Saturday night to book a home-and-away semi-final showdown with the Premier's Melbourne City. We've spoken about the only thing that we can do is perform on the field and do our best to be catalysts for hopefully some positive news that can come, Campbell said. We've just spoken about we can have an effect on what people think about the club, and if people are looking at buying the club, then I don't think that a team of players who are winning and obviously representing Newcastle is a bad thing. So it's not having a negative effect. I think it's actually having a positive effect. The girls understand they're important in ensuring the people who are looking to buy the club or considering buying the club recognise that it's a viable thing. And there's definitely a future in not only what the girls are doing, but also the men at the moment. So for us, it's just being catalysts to try and help that sales process happen. The win over United in extra time was the Jets' first finals victory in three attempts. To reach a grand final, they must beat City across two legs starting in Maitland on Sunday at 3 p.m. We've been looking forward to the chance to play them again, Campbell said. We were disappointed with what we did last time against them and how we performed as an overall. I believe that we've got the players and we've got the form at the moment to compete in that game. If you want to win the competition, you've got to beat the best teams, and for me, Melbourne City are the best team. So if we can get through this two-legged one, then we give ourselves a really good chance of maybe going on and winning it. Meanwhile, 14-year-old multi-sport talent Quive Bray and Newcastle Jets rookie Emma Dundas have been named in the Junior Matilda squad for the AFC Under-17 Asian Cup in Indonesia. Bray, who's also a talented cricketer, is in the Jets Academy and a trainee goalkeeper with their A-League women's side. Dundas, 16, has had a breakout debut season for the Jets to establish herself as a starting A-League midfielder. Both were named in a 23-player Australian under-17 women's squad on Wednesday for May 16th to 19th tournament. And that story was by Renee Valentine, Ownership Uncertainty, Proving Motivation in Finals Series.
Now to page 49. It's an unsolicited article and the title is Stark Struggles Again as Butler Century Downs Knight Raiders. At some point, Kolkata Knight Raiders may have to decide if they can afford to wait for Mitchell Stark to find form. Stark has struggled again to justify his billing as Rajasthan Royals match the highest run chase in Indian Premier League annals, overhauling KKR's 6 for 223 on the final ball at Eden Gardens. The most expensive player in IPL history at $4.43 million, now has 5 wickets for 232 runs in his 6 matches for KKR and averages 10.54 per over. After showing signs of being back to his best on Sunday, when he took 3 for 29 against Lucknow's Super Giants, he was dispatched for 50 in 4 overs. The numbers do not tell the full story. Yashavi Jaswal edged Stark without the ball going to hand in the opening over. Sanju Samson was then dropped off a sitter by Varun Chakravarthy at short third, but it was nevertheless another chastening night for the 34-year-old. England's white ball skipper Joris Butler, so often the scourge of Australians, was his nemesis. Butler made a stunning 107 not out off 60 balls, the last 630 balls as he masterminded a run chase in which he had to turn down singles to keep the strike. Butler hit 29 runs off the 15 legal balls Stark bowled at him, and the left-armer also conceded 8 wides, bowling at the Centurion. Royals' 2-wicket win was harsh on Sunil Narine and Trinidadian all-rounder, who made 109 with the bat, then took 2 for 30 in 4 overs, the best economy rate of an other run fest. He won 3 of the many post-match awards and picked up them without a smile. And that article, which was unattributed, was titled Stark Struggles Again as Butler Century Downs Knight Raiders.
And the last sports story we have time for today is on page 48. It's a lawn bowl story written by Warren Shipley. Newcastle celebrate inter-zone triumph. The Newcastle over-70s side are state interzone champions after their undefeated run at South Tamworth Bowling Club last week. Newcastle posted wins over Central Coast 47-42, Hunter 70-38, and the locals Northwest 58-43 in sectional play before smashing Zone 10 from Northwest Sydney 61-20. The team of Jeff Armstrong, John Gibson, Ross Levido and Sam Laguza won 3 from 4 with a margin of 25. Les Pike, Werner Dietelbacher, Mike Lewis and Mick Beasley had 4 wins plus 34, while Frame, Daryl McKinnon, Glenn Dow, Barry Cartwright and Barry Cartwright all had 4 wins plus 34. Zone 10 were looking to win the event for the third year in session, but the Newcastle Vets were magnificent in the final to claim their second title in this event, the first being in the inaugural year back in 2018. Curry Bowling Club will host Zone 2 Newcastle and Zone 6 Hunter Valley, the 10th staging of the Rod Robards Memorial Shield, on Friday night. The event contested between the Open Men's and Senior Men's representative sides, and this event last chance for players to impress selectors before the Interzone sides are named the BNSW State Side Series in May. And Warren Shipley's story, Newcastle Celebrate Interzone Trough.
Hi, I'm Lucinda Bell, and I present Inpica, readings from the Australian Geographic magazine. This program brings the very best of Australia's nature, culture, people, and places. Hear Geographica every second Wednesday at 6 p.m. and it's repeated on day and Sunday nights on 2RPH, your radio reading service.
With the cooperation of the Newcastle Herald, 2RPH presents a summary of death notices from today's edition.
And we have three death notices in the paper today. And the first one is Square, William Matthew Square, who passed away peacefully in Cairns on the 14th of April 2024. He was aged 93. Also, Lawrence, Richard or Richie Lawrence, late of Waratah West, passed away peacefully on the 15th of April 2024, aged 50 years. And Unicombe, Albert Max or Max Unicombe, late of Mount Hutton and formerly of Charlestown, passed peacefully surrounded by his family on the 10th of April 2024, aged 86 years.
Tune in to 2RPH every day to hear the headlines, news stories and articles from the nation's leading newspapers. Monday to Saturday, you can hear the major stories making the pages of the Sydney Morning Herald, the Daily Telegraph and the Australian, read live by our team of talented volunteers. And on Sundays, what would they be without the Sunday papers? Listeners in Newcastle and the Lower Hunter can hear reading Newcastle Herald from 10 o'clock Monday to Friday and 2 p.m. on Saturday. In Wollongong and the Illawarra, you'll hear the Illawarra Mercury at the same time. So tune in every weekday morning from 7 o'clock, on Saturday from 8 o'clock and on Monday from 10 o'clock. 2RPH, your radio reading service.
And now to page 14 for today's editorial. It's headed Questions, Answers in Letter Saga Report. There's little doubt the Scott Neilan letters began as a matter of opinion. A spate of letters to the Newcastle Herald over several years expressed a variety of views. They came from a pensioner and grandfather and were attributed to a resident of suburbs, including Mayfield West, Mayfield, Dudley or Stockton. The trouble is, they were all under one name. That name happens to belong to City of Newcastle Chief Executive Jeremy Barth's best friend, who is Bay Pan. Mr. Barth and Mr. Neilan have both maintained that Mr. Neilan is the author of the letters which have followed Mr. Barth's career progression. The report from Pinnacle Integrity, released on April the 17th after public pressure, including from this newspaper, on the basis of transparency, found that complaints against Mr. Barth were not substantiated. The report itself came after New South Wales local government minister Ron Hoernig urged the council to inquire. The inquiry is focused on whether a breach of the council's own code of conduct occurred, rather than into the letters themselves as in a broader sense. That may explain why the report never addresses the letters under Mr. Neilan's name, presenting him as a resident of several different suburbs. It does take several allegations made by its witnesses, including an erroneous inference that the Newcastle Herald published street addresses of those involved on face value. In a statement, Pinnacle Integrity described the review as to establish the truth, having regard to available evidence, in a process that scrupulously objective, independent and fair. It goes on to point it cannot seize records nor enforce participation, and that it does not seek to apportion guilt to validate a predetermined or preferred outcome. There would be need to compel this newspaper's participation, as dramatically suggested in the powers mentioned above. Whilst the procedural framework that underpins reviews might not satisfy those desired outcome, conduct reviewers remain bound by those procedures, their statement is. If there is a strongly held or political view that this process needs to change, then that is a matter for the government of the day. That would be Mr. Honig, who in December told this masthead that the current code of conduct is not for purpose and that the system was a shambles. Newspapers do not go to the... and neither does Mr. Barth. The repeated suggestion that asking questions of those paid from the public purse, yet not accountable to voters, only be the work of political enemies, sells both the imagination and the public intelligence short. Questions of probity require no motive, only answers. While the investigators did not contact the Herald, despite its significant inquiries into the letters, they were happy to speak for this newspaper when they suggested Mr. Barth could have written his letters under a John Doe alias to avoid backlash. In the hypothetical case of the city's highest paid bureaucrat talking about issues involving the council, it would surely be difficult to argue his identity is irrelevant to a reader. As Lord Mayor Nuatali Nelms notes in the report, it is hard to limit the scope of conversation between friends. There is reassurance the code of conduct was not breached, but why did Mr. Nayland's letters falsify his suburb? We remain none the wiser. City of Newcastle appears satisfied the matter is at an end. Beyond the council's orbit, though, that too may prove to be a matter of opinion. And that was today's editorial titled Questions, Answers in Letter Saga Report.
And the opinion column in today's paper is on that same page 14, Innovative Hunter on Front Foot in the Renewable World. And it's written by Chris Bowen. Over 24 hours last week, I helped launch construction of a low-carbon manufacturing facility at Kooragang Island, discussed growth plans with the great Tomago battery business, Energy Renaissance, and witnessed the launch of the passionate Hunter Community Alliance with hundreds of Novocastrians. All of this is a reminder, not that I needed one, that when it comes to a future made in Australia, the hunter can be at the centre of the action. I want Australia not only to make renewable energy, but to make that renewable energy. A lot of this can happen in the Hunter, drawing on the world-class University of Newcastle, local TAFEs, and the CSIRO Energy Centre in Mayfield. Countries are decarbonising their economies at a rapid rate. The International Energy Agency estimates that clean energy investment will need to triple by 2030, which they highlight creates opportunities for equipment manufacturers, service providers and energy technology developers. It's a shift that can be advantageous for Australia, but only if we meet demand for new export industries, each worth tens of billions of dollars a year, such as renewable hydrogen, critical minerals, batteries and green metals. More sunlight hits our country than any other. Our wind, onshore and offshore, is above average. We have abundant critical minerals. We have remarkable innovators. Many people know that the modern solar panel was invented in Australia. How many know the flow battery is also a product of the University of New South Wales? or that the only Australian battery that can be fully disassembled or disassembled and recycled is made in Tomago from locally sourced materials. But we can't take it for granted that Australia will capitalise on its advantages. We have half the world's lithium reserves, but capture just 0.53% of the lithium battery supply chain. We can and should be doing more for the processing and manufacturing across supply chains onshore. The Future Made in Australia, announced last week, is the government's plan for supporting local businesses to make the most of the opportunities ahead. It builds on work we've already started. Hydrogen Head Start was announced last year and is progressing rapidly, with six companies shortlisted to kickstart a boom in Australia's green hydrogen industry, supporting future manufacturing and export opportunities. Solar Sunshine, announced in March, is an essential ingredient to Aussie startup SunDrive moving forward with AGL on plans to manufacture their world-leading solar cells in the Hunter. This is a great Australian story. Young Australian scientists producing the most efficient solar cells in the world by swapping out silver for copper, looking to use world-leading energy and industrial know-how to help set up local advanced manufacturing. But Australia isn't alone in wanting a piece of the global net zero transformation. Governments around the world are competing for the best companies and the most investment, making it harder for our companies to thrive in Australia unless we step in. For example, the US government's Inflation Reduction Act, which is focused almost entirely on this decarbonisation opportunity, is estimated to have attracted more than $100 billion in investment and 80,000 jobs in just 2 years. And of course, Europe, Canada, Japan and plenty of others have substantial investment packages to avoid the pool of investment in clean energy manufacturing moving from their countries to the US. Employers, workers, conservation groups and productivity groups have all called on the federal government to step up and compete in this global race by incentivising renewable-related manufacturing in Australia. We agree. It's not an opportunity Australia or the Hunter can afford to miss, and it's not one we will. And that was Innovative Hunter on Front Foot in the Renewable World. And it was written by Chris Bowen, who is the Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
On 2RPH, your radio reading service, this is Your Say, a selection of letters to the editor from today's edition of The Herald.
And the first of today's letters is from Jeff Black of Frankston. Private crimes have very public consequences. Criminal cases must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Civil cases must be proven on the balance of probabilities, a lesser and, I believe, more realistic standard. The judgment by Justice Lee that Bruce Lehrman is a liar and a rapist will allow Brittany Higgins to sue for damages in a civil court. But I expect Miss Higgins is unlikely to do this. Even if Miss Higgins succeeds, Mr. Lehrman probably cannot afford to pay damages and legal fees and is likely to declare bankruptcy. Miss Higgins may need to be satisfied with a moral victory. It is estimated that Australia has 150,000 or more rapes per year, or that 0.6% of men commit rapes every year. Most rapes are not reported to police. By its very nature, rape is a private crime. In a criminal trial, a judge is often faced with a contest of credibility, a he-said-she-said situation. Consequently, only half of men put on trial for rape are convicted. Because of the unlikelihood of success and the certainty of reliving the trauma, if called to the witness stand, most women refuse to criminally charge their rapists. Meanwhile, rapists who go unreported are free to rape again. The law really is an ass, says Jeff Black of Frankston, and support is available for those who may find this article distressing. Phone Respect on 1-800-737-732.
And the second article is by Lorraine Gillett from Fern Bay, who writes about Australia Post. She says, "Well done, Australia Post. I sent an Easter card from Katara to Rutherford. It arrived the week after Easter. I had an Easter card sent to me from Rutherford to Fern Bay, and it arrived 14 days later. Mail came from Sale in Victoria. It only took 5 days, which was much better. I could have caught the train to Maitland and back for $2.50. You have the high increased postage stamps to $1.50, cut delivery days to every second day, and think you're doing a great service. You must be joking. Looks like now we'll have to send our mail a month before if it has any chance of being delivered within a reasonable time. Do the posties get every second day off? There aren't enough parcels to keep every mailroom worker and the posties as well. I think it's a profit rort," says Lorraine Gillett of Fern Bay.
And the next letter is from Bradley O'Dill from Lambton. This is a response to Alyssa Jones' letter regarding underutilised ovals. Yes, Lambton Jaffers have provided fields for their teams at Wallara and Blackley Ovals. Lose them and they will struggle. City of Newcastle's strategic sports plan states that many grounds are underutilised. They fail to mention that a survey was conducted during COVID and post-COVID. No actual statistics are supplied, so it seems a generalisation. Talk to anyone who lives near these ovals or uses them, and they will disagree with this claim. A new study needs to be done so figures are accurate. Grounds are always shared. The new Lambton Junior Soccer Club's opposition to this stadium being built is a reflection of the fact that teams that use these grounds will need to be pushed onto other grounds. The soccer also admirably addressed the other issues surrounding the loss of these grounds. Loss of space, playing fields, how it affects the high school, and the huge impact on public and traffic. All serious issues, but Ms. Jones fails to address them in her letter. Quantities or locations of nearby grounds to be upgraded were not supplied. Just another sweeping statement. We actually need more grounds. There are a proposed 16,600 homes to be built in Broadmeadow. Wake up, Council. These ovals are precious. A basketball stadium needs to be built elsewhere. And that letter was from Bradley O'Dell of Lambton.
And the next letter comes from Bryce Ham of Whitebridge, who writes, "With the expansion of the state Labor government's transport-oriented development planning changes to include Cockle Creek and Cardiff stations, which was detailed in an article in the Herald on the 13th of April, and the changes being finalised this month, time is running out for the government to ensure that this housing opportunity benefits people rather than developers. I attended the Hunter Community Alliance's founding assembly last Wednesday and completely agree with our alliance's call to guarantee at least 15% of the developments are affordable housing. Housing is a human right, not a commodity for profit. It's now up to the Labor Planning Minister, Paul Scully, to listen to our community's calls and guarantee affordable housing as part of these developments," says Bryce Ham of Whitebridge.
And now a letter from Graham Kime of Musselbrook. CEOs from Coles and Woolies have been grilled over alleged price gouging. This has come from the continuing increase in the cost of living in Australia. If this is the case, Australians should be demanding that the government undergo the same grilling and scrutiny, as they are the real reason that the cost of living has skyrocketed. But it's all nothing to see here, says Graham Kime of Musselbrook.
And that's all we have in our reading of today's edition of the Newcastle Herald. Our thanks to the publishers for their cooperation. And just a reminder that 2RPH brings you readings of the Newcastle Herald every weekday at 10 o'clock and also on Saturday afternoons at 2 p.m. Next up on this station, we have another team of volunteers getting ready in the studio next door to read to you from today's edition of The Australian. I'm John Martin. Reading with me today has been Connie Mason, and we thank you for listening to us this morning.
This recording of the Newcastle Herald will remain on the site for a period of 24 hours only, which will expire at 11:30 for Friday. 2RPH sincerely thanks the publisher for cooperation in allowing us to provide this audio file. You are reminded that the material is copyright and is available for personal listening only.